Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 29th, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting this week from Phoenix, Arizona. I spent part of the week in Atlanta, Georgia, got back without any incident this week, enjoyed my time there at the Decision Makers Conference for the Georgia Society of CPAs. And now I've made my way back into town to talk to you about what happened this week in the area of federal taxes. We have a few things happen. One major development we're going to talk about here this week actually happened on April the 11th. But of course, none of us were aware of that because we had other things we were doing, at least many of us did, on that date. It did finally get noticed, and actually got noticed last weekend, just after I had finished recording the program for last week. Glenn Birnbaum on Twitter noticed the IRS had changed their frequently asked questions on 199 Cap A. We'll discuss specifically about one answer that's causing a lot of angst among tax professionals, and we'll talk about how that works. We'll also talk about some results here on a case where a taxpayer found he had multiple trades or businesses. You can't really just pick and choose which one you'd like to take a deduction on to get the maximum tax benefit. We'll talk about what happened there. The IRS did update the EPCRS program for plan, you know, retirement plan, fixing problems in such plans. And specifically this time in the restatement of the program, they expanded the number of options that sponsors of the plan have to correct problems under the self-correction program. We'll talk about that. We'll also briefly talk about how we still have to worry about Department of Labor compliance. And we'll talk specifically about one area where the IRS has added a self-correction program for an issue, but the Department of Labor, for the moment, is not going along with that way of correcting something. They're going to require you to go another route to get that done. We also will talk about a chief counsel email. It talks about a strategy I've heard some people advance about hiring a professional, using a professional employer organization to be the employer of partners of a partnership in order to escape fringe benefit limitations. The IRS email turns out they don't believe that works. And we'll discuss the nature of why they say it doesn't work, and as well as what the implications this might have for us, and kind of look at that background. Well, as I said, I'm back here in the Valley of the Sun, here in Phoenix, and it's still relatively reasonable temperatures here. We've been in the 80s this week, upper 80s, mid 80s. When it was in Atlanta this week, Phoenix was in the upper 80s. Atlanta was having highs in the mid 80s, in the low 80s, I should say. But Atlanta was a lot more humid than Phoenix, so it was kind of, what, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, how you felt in either location. But I'm back here. We know much worse is coming in Phoenix because summer is coming, and we're going to be seeing those temperatures, and we'll see if we decide to hit 120 this year or not. That's always, you know, that's always a big question. How hot will it get? But we all invite you out here for July. I'm sure the hotels would love to see you out here in July. You might not like it so much, but hey, if you stay indoors, it's great. Of course, that's also true in Minneapolis in the winter. If you stay indoors, it's just fine. Yeah, we're into that mode of the year. So it's always interesting. And when you have tax season in Arizona, you know that when you finish your tax season, you're going to be staring down at the heat. So we're enjoying, those of us who did tax here in Arizona, in Phoenix, shouldn't they, deserts in Arizona, are actually enjoying what we can now of the really good weather, because it's not going to last. Let's start with our first case for this week, the case of Ferguson versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-40. It was released on April the 23rd of 2019. This involved an individual who is involved in construction. Now, this gentleman has a bunch of different businesses he runs, all of which are construction related. He had at least two S corporations for the year in question that did construction related work. He also had a C corporation. He ran other businesses through Schedule C's. So he basically had, you know, all kinds of entities and all types of structures. The particular issue in question in today's case involved a customer complaint on work done on a custom home. Mr. Ferguson C Corporation was in the business of building custom homes for individuals. He had an S Corporation that sold lots on which the homes would be built. And he also had another S Corporation that was involved in cast stone. it would create, manufacture the cast stone. It would also install cast stone. This complaint from a customer involved a customer who purchased purchased the lot, got the custom home going to be built by the C Corporation, wanted to use this cast stone on columns. You know, I suppose some great Grecian, the Grecian columns, Roman columns, I have no idea, but nevertheless, these big stone columns they wanted in the home. So, Mr. Ferguson obviously recommended, his C Corporation recommended the use of the product from the S Corporation and also having the S Corporation install the product on the job. And the customer did that. When the job was completed, the customer was not happy with it. The customer claimed that it failed, that it was improperly manufactured, improperly installed, it had to be replaced, and they filed this large claim against him, for having essentially botched the work. And they filed the claim against the S Corporation that sold him a lot. They filed the claim against the C Corporation that, was the contractor who built the home. They filed it against the S Corporation, which manufactured the stone, and they filed against Mr. Ferguson personally. Might as well name everybody when you're going after money. So at this point, Mr. Ferguson, he has, as I said, multiple businesses. In addition to the businesses I just mentioned, he also ran a separate business on his individual return reported on Schedule C that was involved in commercial construction. They finally settled this deal, and what he did was he transferred certain lots to this customer, and he paid funds to this customer to settle the suit. Now, the problem becomes, of course, where exactly should this be deducted? The IRS agreed that this clearly related to business activities, and that these business activities he was entered into for a profit. So somewhere there was a deduction to be claimed, but the question was, where somewhere? Well, Mr. Ferguson initially recorded this as he treated the payments of the funds as loans to the S Corporation, and then he recorded the entire payoff as a payoff from the S Corporation to the, to the customer, and took that as an expense, and that flowed through onto his personal return. Now, at which point he took the deduction. Now, the IRS came in and challenged this, and they said there's a number of problems. The S Corporation didn't really pay for the work, for the settlement. It was paid personally. They said, secondly, the actual liability didn't relate to him personally. So, he really wasn't the one, the real problem was the S Corp and the C Corp, in their view. In fact, was the C Corp, the IRS views entirely. And basically, they were disallowing it. Well, the taxpayer said, first thing is to say, no, the S Corp should be able to claim it. But even if not, then it was paid personally, then I should be able to take it on that Schedule C commercial business that I've got. Because then it represents a trade or business expense of mine. It should go on the personal, and it would go on my Schedule C, and I'd get the full deduction. So, I should get a full deduction either way. The tax court said, look, let's start with first thing is, whose liability really was this? He said, obviously, based on the origin of the claims, this related to the schedules to the C Corp that built custom homes, and it related to the S Corp that manufactured and installed the cast stone. It did not relate in any way, shape, or form to his commercial business. So the idea that we could somehow put on a Schedule C, they said, we can just reject that out of hand. That's not possible. The court also said, we got to divide it between these two businesses in some way, shape, or form. Well, given the evidence we've got, given what we've heard, given what went on, we're going to say that half of this claim should have been paid by the C Corp and half related to the work done by the S Corp. So we also aren't going to likely claim a full deduction on the S Corp return for this particular loss, because that was not an expense of the S Corp. So it doesn't matter. It can't be claimed there. Now, of course, Mr. Ferguson had recorded this as a loan to the S Corp. The tax court also said, we don't think it's a loan. It's not a loan because you had no reasonable expectation of repayment. The court tells us that, in fact, you know, basically, he shut down the S-Corp the next year. He and his CPA agreed that at the time that this settlement was paid, there was very little chance that the S-Corp would ever have any funds to be able to repay him. So the court found that this was a contribution of capital. They also found in the same way, you know, that basically, you know, like I said, the other half related to the C-Corp. So on the S-Corp, they said they gave a deduction. They also didn't allow him to treat as an ordinary loss the loss on sale of the lots, because apparently the lots were worth less fair value than he had paid for them. So they said, no, that's a capital loss, but that's a separate part of the case. But now they've got this other half of the payment he made to settle this lawsuit. And that relates to the C-Corp. Well, the IRS had taken the position it was an employee business expense. The tax court said, well, since the IRS has agreed that it could be an employee business expense, we will accept that treatment. Now, of course, that means back in the year in question, it was subject to 2% of AGI limitation, and it was not deductible for AMT purposes. But the tax court also made it fairly clear that had they been left to their own devices, they would have probably just said it was a contribution of capital, non-deductible. So he couldn't deduct it, neither could the company. And that basically it would just be a non-deductible contribution of capital to the C-Corp. And maybe the C-Corp became a loss for it. That'd be a whole other issue. They said, but since the IRS conceded employee business expense, they're not going to argue the point. They'll let it be an employee business expense. Now, remember, under the current law, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, being an employee business expense would be the worst outcome possible because employee business expenses are considered totally non-deductible. Why is it employee business expense? Because he was an employee of the C-Corp. And so they said it's employee business expense from that standpoint. It was a C-Corp. The S-Corp, apparently, he didn't draw a salary from because it was hemorrhaging funds left and right, had no money to pay him a salary. So arguably, you know, they didn't go down that route there and make the S-Corp take it that way, but they did, you know, say that, yeah, employee business expense. So this is fair warning. Be careful here, especially with clients like Mr. Ferguson that tend to have all these set up, all these entities, and they can be a little fast and loose about where expenses should be deducted. Take care to document that expenses are being taken on the right entity, especially when that treatment can obviously have a clear tax impact that is clearly better if it's on one than another. The court will be properly skeptical, as they were here, when the entire expense shows up someplace that gives maximum benefit. In this case, a place where it could flow directly to the front page of his 1040. I suppose I shouldn't say front page of 1040 anymore, because now it's really page 2, and maybe it's actually schedule 1. Yeah, the new 1040 is a little confusing. But in any event, they put it where it would go into the computation of AGI. Just be careful there. Now let's talk about a little surprise we got. In fact, tax analyst actually picked up from the blog a term I had used where we said it was a nasty surprise, right? That they put a nasty surprise on us during late in tax season. There's a page on the IRS website that's titled Tax Cuts and Jobs Act Provision 11001, Section 199, Cap A, Qualified Business Income Deduction Facts, Frequently Asked Questions. On 4/11 of 2019, the IRS posted an update. Now since then, it's shown as being revised again. It's not clear. I haven't seen anybody yet who's quite figured out what exactly they changed afterwards. But what they did on 4/11 was added a lot of questions. The Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, that archives websites, that's all they do is they archive websites and you can go access. So it means you can kind of roll a website back in time. The Internet Archive had taken a snapshot of this page on April the 7th. On April the 7th, there were 12 questions and answers here, and they're ones we'd seen before. We kind of knew this, and there was nothing big on this, so it'd been kind of ignored. On April the 11th, 4 days before the filing deadline, the IRS adds 21 questions and answers to the site. As you might guess, that's a significant amount of detail that we did not have until April the 11th about how the IRS views the proper treatment of items under Section 199 Cap A. And more specifically, which was really helpful here, it tells us how they view the final regulations and how they viewed the proposed regulations. Because remember, for 2018, we could elect to use proposed regulations if we wanted to. The big problem, what got everybody aware and what Glenn had mentioned, Glenn Birnbaum, who noticed this Saturday morning, like a week ago, you know, he noticed this on the IRS website, was the answer to the last question, question 33. Question 33 dealt with S corporations and the self-employed health insurance deduction. And what question 33 says, last question, you'll find it there right at the end, health insurance premiums paid by an S corporation for greater than 2% shareholders reduce qualified business income at the entity level by reducing the ordinary income used to compute allocable QBI. Right? So far, so good. If I take, this is always the taxpayer asking the question, if I take the self-employed health insurance deduction for these premiums on my individual tax return, do I have to also include this deduction when calculating my QBI from the S corporation? This question came up on a couple of discussion groups I've been involved in, and everybody noted that there was no direct answer in the regulations. Nothing specifically dealt with this. Because the problem we know, as this question 33 tells us, the S corporation takes the deduction for paying the health insurance premiums. But because of the special rule under Section 1372 that treats a greater than 2% shareholder as if they were a partner for purposes of fringe benefits, what we end up doing is taking that shareholder's premiums, adding them to their W-2, treating that as payment of wages, not subject to FICA withholding, not subject to Medicare withholding, and not, or Medicare withholding or tax, I should say either one, FICA withholding or tax, and also not subject to unemployment. So non-FUTA, non-FICA, non-Medicare wages. The individual person then reports that higher level of wages on their form 1040. They then compute the self-employed health insurance deduction if they otherwise qualify. They don't have disqualifying coverage, you know, from a spouse. So a spouse doesn't, they couldn't have the option to sign up, let's say, for a subsidized policy of their spouse or maybe, you know, their own employer, if they have an employer as well. So we take that deduction. So we offset that extra wage amount by the self-employed health deduction. So technically, we do deduct it twice, right? It was deduct the S level. Their share of that flows out, and then it's deducted again here. But we also throw extra income on their W-2, which offsets the extra deduction. In discussions on the forums, most people had come to the conclusion, well, it doesn't seem to make sense you double deduct it. I mean, that doesn't make sense. And the idea became, well, probably the better way to view that is that the salary represents the income in this case. For an S shareholder, that salary is the income that gives rise to the deduction. And that salary is non-QBI. It's not qualified business income because employer, you know, wages are not qualified business income, right? General rule. So, okay, no double deduction. I think most people reported it that way. I also know that tax software generally was not picking that up as an extra deduction. Well, the IRS answer is not quite what you might expect. Answer 33 starts, generally, the self-employed health insurance deduction under Section 162L is considered attributable to a trade or business for purposes of Section 199 Cap A and will be deduction determining QBI. This may result in QBI being reduced at both the entity and the shareholder level. In essence, we may deduct it twice. Now, that caused a lot of consternation because most people didn't believe there would be a double deduction. Now, I do point out that there are a couple of weaselly words in there, you know, where we kind of weasel out of this and we're not going to commit. It says generally it's deducted, and it may result in a double deduction. But I still think, you know, it's pretty clear the IRS's view is that you have to take it. So to give us an example, let's take an S corporation has, let's say, $100,000 of income before officer's salary. And so let's say we pay $50,000 in salary, and then we pay $10,000 to pay the officer's health insurance that was in there. So part of our regular deductions are the health insurance. So we have $50,000 of net income that flows out to the part to this shareholder. Let's say they own 100% of the entity. We add $10,000 to the W-2. Okay, so we're going to report $60,000 of wages. We're going to report $50,000 of income from the S corp. But then, assuming that they're not eligible for subsidized coverage elsewhere, we're going to take the $10,000 off. Okay, thus we're going to report $100,000 worth of income. We would have, in our normal view, we'd think we'd have $50,000 QBI. That's what comes out of the S corporation. That's what's on the K-1. But the way the IRS phrases this is, no, we've got to take that $50,000, which already has been reduced by the 10, and reduce it by 10 more. So effectively, we are double deducting the 10. If that same individual had been a proprietorship, obviously they wouldn't have had wages, so we'd ignore that. But we'd have only had the one single 10 grand. We wouldn't have deducted the 10 grand at all on Schedule C. We would have deducted it on the front page of the 1040. And that meant we would then that one time reduce QBI by that 10 grand. Well, that's not what happened here. Lots of other things happened here, but that little detail was not what happened. Other than that, actually, this thing was not that bad. It has some interesting clarifications on flow-throughs. And the interesting part about that, we have a lot of this discussion, right? But if you look at the answers in there, and we have this in the printed material, I've got a lot of these answers spread out. There's been a problem all tax season with, you know, you got a K-1 from a partnership, and that partnership, your taxpayer was not actively involved, you know, was passive. And that partnership throws off a $20,000 loss, and we see $20,000 in negative QBI. Your taxpayer has no other passive income. He didn't dispose of the partnership this year, so he takes no deduction for that $20,000. However, there's still that $20,000 QBI, negative QBI number flowing through from the K-1. Well, our question comes up. Do we still pick up that negative 20? Most tax software was still picking up that negative 20. And so let's say you had $100,000 of QBI otherwise because you ran a profitable Schedule C business. They'd reduce that by that $20,000 loss, even though we didn't get it this year. Now, the IRS has a whole long discussion in the regulations about the fact that, you know, passive losses carry over. We deduct them in the year in which, you know, we treat them as negative QBI in the year in which we actually claim the deduction. But it never said that that overrode the calculation at the flow-through entity. It just is kind of silent on that. The IRS makes very clear in these facts that, no, you have to do an evaluation. You can't just take the QBI number from the partnership. There are various things that will impact QBI that cannot be determined until we get to the shareholder level. For instance, could the shareholder claim the 179 deduction for the 179, you know, that was passed out? If the answer to that is no, we have to essentially remove that deduction from the QBI calculation. If the taxpayer, let's say, had a basis problem, then, and we only got to deduct half the loss, then we've got to adjust our QBI for the fact that we had a partial loss disallowance. Maybe the partnership kicked out 1231 income. Well, that might be part of QBI. If it turns out it's going to be taxed as a ordinary income item because we have all these offsetting 1231 losses from other things we were doing, maybe we have 1231 recaptures, so it's an ordinary loss. You know, there are various reasons, or maybe it's a capital gain, it's not in there. Well, we have to figure out what happened at 1231 gain and then figure out how the partnership computed its QBI and properly adjust it. The Q&A makes very clear, the fact makes very clear that the partnership has to distribute all the information necessary for each partner to make those determinations, and you make those determinations at the partner level. The frequently asked questions also make it clear that the same treatment carries over to publicly traded partnerships, so PTP issues. We have the carryover there. That's crucial. We also found out real estate professional status, not relevant. You don't get out of quality, you know, your rental's not automatically trader business because you're a real estate pro. They probably are anyway, but they're not automatically. Some people thought maybe that was the key. And oh, by the way, remember the fact that you could use the proposed regs? And some people said, wait, the proposed reg said nothing about, you know, self-employed health insurance or deducting retirement plan contributions or deducting the self-employed, the self-employment tax deduction for self-employed individuals on the front page of the return. So we could ignore all those deductions as long as we said we're using the proposed regs for 18. Question 32 makes it very clear. The IRS clarified but did not change the regulations in the final regulations on this issue. The IRS takes position. Those are all clearly related to the trader business deductions under the proposed regulations. And therefore, under the proposed regulations, they had to be subtracted. If you subtracted them, if you did not take them off because you elected to use the 2018 proposed regs, the return in the IRS's view is an error. Now, at the bottom of this fact, they do make very clear that this is non-binding. In fact, Annette Nellen, who's quoting the article that was in Tax Analyst this week, in Tax Notes this week, you know, noted that she had never seen that at the bottom of one of these frequently asked question pages. So it's not binding. Theoretically, you can try to take the opposite position, but it certainly tells you what we expect the service to assert. So I would go back, look at these. If you've taken positions contrary to this, you might discuss it with the client, especially if you did not file a Form A275 to disclose the position on the return. If you did, you might discuss with them and say, well, if we get examined, the IRS is more likely than not now, I think, to disagree with our treatment. But, you know, but because we disclosed, we're probably going to be OCAM penalties. If we didn't disclose, then I think I'd have an open discussion that a penalty might be asserted. For taking the position. And remember, there is a lower threshold for the substantial understatement penalty when we have 199 CAP A in play. So, you know, you might want to take a look at that again. It's not binding. I don't say you have to do something right now, but I would say that you might want to consider at least having a discussion with clients if we have clients who have positions contrary to these positions on the returns. Let's talk about a couple of other things here at the end of this today. Next one I want to talk about is for those of you in a qualified plan arena, Revenue Procedure 2019-19, very long document because they republished the EPCRS program information. It was issued on April the 19th of 2019. What they said in that was, this is the program that allows taxpayers to correct retirement plan problems. Key thing to remember, this is only the IRS's corrections. Most, not all, but most retirement plans are subject to governance by both the Department of Labor and the IRS. EPCRS, the Employee Plan Compliance Resolution System, that only corrects IRS penalties, does not necessarily help you with Department of Labor. The Department of Labor has a separate program that they run called the Voluntary Fiduciary Correction Program, or the VFC program. But this does help us because obviously the IRS penalties are at least a set of penalties we'd like to get out of. So what happened here was the IRS expanded the self-correction program. And you can read about it in the document. One key area they expanded in was in the area of correcting plan loan problems. And we'll mention that here in a second because that causes an issue with the Department of Labor. But the self-correction programs means you don't have to go to the IRS. The alternative programs besides self-correction that you have under this are the voluntary correction program, the VCP. There you do go to the IRS and you get basically blessed. There's a fix you agree to do, and you pay the IRS a limited fee, which is less than the max, far less than the max they could assert. And you get the IRS's approval for the VCP program. The third program that comes enlisted here is the CAP audit cap. Corrections on audit, that gets the worst result, right? That's where they're going to much more throw the book at you for how you correct things if the issue is first discovered on exam. So there's definitely an incentive to come forward voluntarily. Now, the issue I was mentioning here, though, that we run into is the IRS attempted in this case. In this case, expands what we can do to fix problematical plan loans, right? But the Department of Labor said they will not grant VFC relief under for most plan loan problems unless you have from the IRS a VCP, Voluntary Correction Program letter. So until this gets resolved a little differently, you may very well find that even though the IRS says you can self-correct, if your plan is subject to Department of Labor jurisdiction, you may still need to go through the more complex voluntary correction program and pay a fee to the IRS to get the letter blessing your fix before the Department of Labor will let you off the hook under VFC. So one of those things to keep an eye on if you're involved in qualified plans. You need to be aware, though, that the EPCRS program now, there's a new document to work from. And it was effective on date of publication, so it's effective now. Our final development for this week is something I've heard a lot of PEOs pushing. This is the IRS's email from Chief Counsel, 2019-16-004. It was issued on April the 19th of 2019. Some professional employer organizations, especially given some of the issues we've run into now with, you know, limitations on employee business expenses and other issues, they had argued that proposed regulations under 7705 specifically blessed, and they did the preamble is where they were looking, specifically blessed getting around the limitations by having a professional employer organization hire all the employees of the partnership and hire the partners to perform services for the partnership, then contract with the PEO. The PEO would then obviously pay your employees, right? And pay the partners. By doing so, the partners would then arguably be able to get those employee benefits that you can't get if you're a partner, because they would be an employee of the PEO, not of the partnership. And as an employee of the PEO, they would not be restricted from getting the deduction, right? Doesn't matter. Now, this is interesting because these same PEOs were screaming all year about, you gotta say these people are really employees of the partnership for purposes of getting the 199 cap A deduction. You know, you've got to say, you know, you can't do this. We'll be out of business. Every proprietorship and partnership will fire us for, you know, they won't let us handle their employees because they're afraid they won't get 199 cap A W-2 wages. Well, unfortunately, the IRS view is you can't have it both ways. And secondly, it's not a choice which way you get it. The IRS memo makes very clear. They said that preamble is discussing when a non-partner in a partnership or any other structure may be doing work both as an employee for the entity and as a, you know, as an independent contractor. The example they would use, maybe you've got somebody like an accountant in your office, employee accountant in your office, who also owns a cleaning business. I don't know why they do, but they do. And we pay their cleaning business, Schedule C cleaning business, to do the janitorial work at night in the office. And we pay them as an employee to do the accounting work. Two obviously distinct and different roles. There they say the PEO would report the W-2 wages, you know, would report the work by that person on, you know, that's W-2 wages and consider wages paid. And we would continue to have to report the janitorial work on a 1099. Well, that been kind of expanded to say, see, we can hire anybody, even though they're otherwise a contract labor person or they're not an employee, they're not employees. IRS says, no, that's not true. They specifically cite back to their old revenue rulings on the fact that partners can never be an employee of a partnership. They said that is still true. Being a employee, if you're, you know, when the partner is hired by the PEO, they remain a partner of the partnership. That is still considered a guaranteed payment of the partnership when it's paid to them. And that is still considered to be non-wages, right? So it's not wages for purposes of employee benefits either. So partners in this case cannot be employees even if there's a PEO stuck in the middle. That would carry forward, for obvious reasons, should carry forward to the Schedule C owner of the business. And I suspect it carries to 2% shareholders of S corporations under the same logic. That, you know, that in fact, you know, the IRS position will be, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't tell me these people are not employees of the S corp, but are employees of the PEO, and then, you know, and say under 199 cap A, but no, but they're employees for the limitation purposes. Now, basic rule. Now be careful there, because yes, there's been a lot of PEOs out there who have been arguing and telling people that this is fine. We can set up programs to offer benefits to the partners. The partners can get the full range of all the employee benefits and not treat it like a self-employed health insurance payment. You know, not have to worry about that. They could participate in a medical expense reimbursement program because it doesn't matter, because they're employees and they're being paid under an expense reimbursement program of the employer. Which would be the PEO. And suggests maybe this doesn't work quite as well as we thought. So just be aware of that limitation. Now, again, this is just an email. It is not binding. Be very careful there. However, I do say this. I think as a CPA, if you have a client who is doing this, I do think you have a responsibility to tell them that the IRS has gone on the record. This is an email they knew would be released, and it's very clearly written, knowing it's going to be released. And it specifically addresses taxpayers taking this position to exam. That the IRS may, you know, the IRS position is out there that says we can't do this. We need to talk to the PEO about why they think we can do this. Now, if the PEO is saying that somehow it's different hiring through them, I don't know. I think you got a better shot for partners, at least under 707A, and trying to argue that, in fact, the IRS views on the rev rulings and the regulation maybe is questionably valid, because 707A talks about a partnership can have a relationship with a partnership that's not in the nature of an employee. But you wouldn't need a PEO then to make it work. If there's some theory where we have to have a PEO to make it work, that argument to me gets a little tougher. If the reg is valid and the ruling is valid, and I am not saying they're not, I'm just saying that if you're going to attack them, I know where I'd try to go to attack the situation. I'm not going to tell you you're going to win that argument. I'm going to tell you, though, that's at least where the better argument lies. I see nothing that suggests to me that somehow having a PEO in the middle should change the result. In fact, we tried to ignore PEOs because, let's remember, for 199 Cap A, we wanted to ignore them. That was the whole point. Hey, look, tax season's over now. I know those of us here in Arizona now have begun receiving our CPE catalogs. By the way, the Arizona one this year, you may notice, much thinner. They got rid of course descriptions, right? But they do have a calendar in this, and it lets you put out my calendar. I don't know about you, but I always kind of just use the calendar anyway to map out my CPE, find courses I liked, and make sure the day was open. You know, that's kind of how I do it. But those are out there now. Be sure to take a look. If you get a printed catalog, look at that. Otherwise, go to your society's website. Get ready now. Register. There's a lot happening this year. Many things are going to be happening. Remember, most of the guidance for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is either not out at all or is not yet come out in final form. All of that we expect to happen this year. So get ready, you know, get your CPE, get prepped, sign up. Your state society offers a bunch of options. Check out those options. Sure, I hope you come to the courses that I'm going to be teaching. I'll be teaching around the country this year. But in any event, make sure you get something in there, because it's going to be a very, very active year in tax, and you want to make sure you don't get left behind. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 29th, 2019. You can catch my updates when we release them during the week. We post them at the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Questions and comments, you can send those to me. My email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. It's @edzollers. I also follow discussions on the subreddit of reddit.com/r/taxpros. You can also find me on the Connect discussion groups for this Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota Society of CPAs. I also look into Cal CPA's tax talk groups, these things happening there. You can check in any of those places. You know, hopefully you got something, post something there, and there'll be a bunch of us who are probably going to be willing to chip in and talk about those things. And otherwise, we'll just watch, see what happens for next week, and we'll hopefully see you back here next week as we talk about what goes on in current federal tax developments.